Good morning. It's always good to be here with you. It's been an exciting weekend in the big city of Nanaimo. Emily and I attended a family wedding yesterday, and it was also a good excuse for my brother and his family to come over for the weekend, and so we had them with us for the weekend, and it was a great joy, as always, to see our nephew and our nieces playing together in our backyard. I think our chickens aren't thoroughly traumatized. I think they're getting used to being chased and handled by little ones. And Emily won the bet. We had a bet going in terms of who would, which one of our nieces or nephew would fall into our pond first. So it's been a great weekend with them. And as things were unfolding last night with Thomas and Destiny, we were getting updates throughout the night, text messages and phone calls. So it's been really feel really blessed this weekend, and it's a blessing to be able to share God's word with you. And as I was heading out the door this morning, there was Naomi in our woodshed trying to get some sleep. We had high-quality Coleman mattress that we had inflated, and it sprung a leak. So there was Naomi in our woodshed on this half-deflated mattress, trying to get some shut-eye as she was up all night. But like I said, it was a great weekend, and it's Mother's Day, of course. So I wanted to wish you all a happy Mother's Day, and it's always a privilege to get to share God's word with you. But I think especially today, where we give special recognition to our moms and to the special women in our lives. You know, if you think about it, for many of us, it was through our moms or our wives or some godly women that we first heard of faith in Christ. And so I hope that this morning what I prepared will be both encouraging and appreciative as well. And so along those lines of thought, I thought that the book of Ruth would be appropriate for this morning. Emily and I had been reading through the Old Testament together, and we had read through the book of Ruth about 2 months ago, and the story stuck with me. There were a number of things that stuck with me, but as I was thinking about Mother's Day and preparing for this morning, I thought, you know, many of the qualities that we admire so much about motherhood are qualities that we see depicted in this story, especially in the person of Ruth. We see that that selfless expression of love. We see courage in the face of fear and uncertainty, and yet tenderness and compassion through it all. And one of the qualities that really stuck out to me, and which I want to focus in on this morning, is the power of a simple faith working itself out in love. A faith that at first glance may not have seemed particularly glamorous, but a faith that was real, and a faith that sought to not only grapple with the harsh realities that they faced, but a faith that also sought to bring to expression the great grace and healing and justice of God into our world. So, and you know, as important as that is, as an example and as encouraging as I hope that is, even more importantly, what I think we see in this story is the great faithfulness of God. God working behind the scenes, as it were, and yet weaving together his good purposes and designs. And even when the people in the story suffer tragedy, and even when they are forced to carry on with the menial tasks of everyday life, God was there. He was with them. He had not forgotten them. And he was working out his good purposes, which were far greater than what the people themselves could have imagined. So this morning, as we look at the book of Ruth, let's be thankful for the faith of our moms and the many godly women in our lives who have expressed that faith in so many ways to us. And let's also try and glimpse together the great faithfulness of God and how his love, his goodness, is never failing. So verse 1 of chapter 1 of the book of Ruth really sets the stage for the story, and it lets us know that all things were not well in the land of Judah where this story begins. This is how the first verse in the book of Ruth goes. It says, during the time of the judges. Now let's just stop there for a moment and let's think, what was going on during the time of the judges? Well, I think it was fair to say that it was truly one of the dark periods in the history of the nation of Israel. The people of Israel had turned their backs on God to follow their own ways. God had said to seek mercy, you know, to love mercy, seek justice, to walk humbly before him, and instead they had turned to worship idols, they had twisted justice, and had oppressed the poor. I think, you know, a lot of dark things had gone on during that time. Some good things too, but I think a fair summary of that book, the book of Judges, comes at the very last verse. And the last verse, the book of Judges, says this. It says, each man did what he considered to be right. So it wasn't a matter of what was right before God or what was good for one's neighbor. It was what each person considered to be right in his or her own eyes. And to be living in a time where there was no government, there was no king, and in terms of Israel, Joshua had died. And in such circumstances, as is often the case, it was the vulnerable in society who were the first to be taken advantage of. So that's the context in which this story is taking place, not a very easy time to be living. But so far, we've not even read through half of verse 1 in chapter 1, so let's continue. So during the time of the judges, there was a famine in the land of Judah. So already the story's gone from bad to worse, and as the story continues, it begins to focus in on this small family. This small family who were forced to flee their home and become refugees in a foreign land. So it says, so a man from Bethlehem in Judah went to live as a resident foreigner in the region of Moab, along with his wife and two sons. Now the man's name was Elimelech, his wife was Naomi, and his two sons were Mahlon and Chilion. They were of the clan of Ephrath from Bethlehem in Judah. They entered the region of Moab and settled there. And as this small family is living as refugees in this land, tragedy strikes the family. Verse 3. Sometime later, Naomi's husband, Elimelech, died. So she and her two sons were left alone. So her sons married Moabite women. One was named Orpah and the other Ruth. And they continued to live there about 10 years. And if it were not enough to be living during a time where there was, you know, injustice and poverty, and then to, you know, suffer tragedy in one's family, the story goes on to describe how this woman, Naomi, would have to suffer further loss. Verse 5, then Naomi's two sons, Mahlon and Chilion, also died. So the woman was left all alone, bereaved of her two children as well as her husband. So here is Naomi, grieving the loss of her entire family, and as a woman in that day and age, without a husband, without children, she was incredibly vulnerable. And the question of her survival was a real issue. So Naomi decides to return back home to Judah. She hears the famine is now over, and perhaps there are relatives there or friends who can help her in some way. And as Naomi makes plans to head back to her homeland, it appears that her two daughters-in-law will accompany her to help support her. But as Naomi makes it perfectly clear to her daughters-in-law that to follow her would not be wise, it would not be in their own interest to remain with her, we see the true character of both Orpah and Ruth made clear. So this is what Naomi says in verse 17 now, chapter 1, as she's in her grief and sorrow, she tries to push away her daughter-in-laws. She says this in, verse 8. Naomi said to her two daughter-in-laws, listen to me. Each of you should return to your mother's home. May the Lord show you the same kind of devotion that you have shown to your deceased husband and to me. May the Lord enable each of you to find security in the home of a new husband. Then she kissed them goodbye, and they wept loudly. But they said to her, No, we will return with you to your people. But Naomi replied, Go back home, my daughters. There is no reason for you to return to Judah with me. I am no longer capable of giving birth to sons who might become your husbands. Go back home, my daughters, for I am too old to get married again. And even if I thought that there was hope that I could get married tonight and conceive sons, surely you would not want to remain married until they were old enough. Surely you would not remain unmarried all that time. No, my daughters, you must not return with me, for my intense suffering is too much for you to bear, for the Lord is afflicting me. Again, they wept loudly. Then Orpah kissed her mother-in-law goodbye, but Ruth clung tightly to her. So as Naomi made it perfectly clear for them to remain with her, would not be at all in their best interest. And what Naomi is trying to say is that I'm useless to you. And for all that they could tell, that was the case. To remain with her mother-in-law meant insecurity, meant hopelessness, suffering. Not a very attractive option for two young women with their whole lives in front of them. And Orpah makes what many people would have considered to be the wise choice. Right, both financially and socially, she turns away. But Ruth, and for good reason, is often held up as one of the great examples of what true friendship looks like. There was no personal advantage for Ruth to stay with Naomi. In fact, there appeared to be a great many disadvantages. And this really gives us reason to pause and reflect upon the nature of friendship, what it really means, what it looks like. Because it's, you know, in our culture, we often miss the mark. We often fall far short of what true friendship means. And some have even said that in our consumerism society, that relationships themselves have become disposable, right? So relationships have become about, what can I get from someone else? How can someone else meet my wants, my needs, my desires? And as soon as someone stops meeting my needs, wants, and desires, then that person is discarded, right? They're disposable. But hear how Ruth replies to her mother-in-law. And these words sound almost like marriage vows. Verse 16 of chapter 1, Ruth replied to Naomi, Stop urging me to abandon you. For wherever you go, I will go. Wherever you live, I will live. Your people will become my people, and your God will become my God. Wherever you die, I will die, and there I will be buried. May the Lord punish me severely if I do not keep my promise. Only death will be able to separate me from you. Wow. What Ruth is really telling her mother-in-law is that her reality will become her own. She's saying, I will never abandon you, regardless of the circumstances, regardless of the personal cost to my own comfort or prosperity, I will never leave you. And so here is Ruth, who then leaves behind her own family, her own culture, and even religion, and so leaves behind whatever earthly security she may have had. And it even says that Ruth took an oath before God to keep her promise. She says, May the Lord punish me severely if I do not keep my promise. And some might have said, you know, this was an example of a foolish kind of faith or an example of taking things too far. And, you know, that's often how our world looks at faith and looks at religion today. They say, you know, believe whatever you want to believe, so long as you're moderate about it. You know, they say the problem with religion is extremism and fundamentalism, and that might be the case for some religions. I don't know, but it's not the case for Christianity. Michael Ramsden, who's a well-known Christian apologist who's traveled the globe and has had the chance of not only defending the Christian faith, but of engaging with different Christians from different cultures. And what he's observed is that the more you push Christianity to the extremes, the more real it becomes, the more powerful it becomes. And he said, if there is an issue with faith in the West and Christianity in the West, it's not that we're extremists, it's that we're too moderate. It's not that we're fundamentalists, it's that we've forgotten the fundamentals of the gospel. Jesus never called us to love with moderation. He never called us to forgive with moderation. And as the Apostle John says in 1 John chapter 3, one of my favorite verses, he says, we know what real love looks like because Jesus laid down his life for us. And so we too ought to lay down our lives for our brothers and our sisters. And so here is Ruth laying down her life. Here is Ruth pushing her perhaps newfound faith to the extreme. And as she would soon discover, it was there. It was there in that place of faith that God was working. It was there in that place of faith that God was guiding and God was providing. So Ruth travels with Naomi back to Judah, back to the city of Bethlehem. And it says that the entire village was excited to see the return of Naomi. But Naomi tells them, don't call me by my name, call me Mara, which means bitter. She goes on to say that the Lord has opposed me. The Lord has caused me to suffer. Naomi says, I left here full, and I have returned empty-handed. Naomi, she wasn't lying when she told Ruth that to follow her would mean some form of suffering. It would be a trial. Naomi's statement that she returned empty-handed was highly ironic, because here was Ruth having given up her fullness, so to speak, so that Naomi would not be empty-handed. But at least Naomi is honest, because she admits that her suffering has made her bitter, and who could blame her? You know, she felt that God must have turned his back on her, or perhaps even worse, turned his hand against her. Maybe she thought there was some unknown sin that God was punishing her for. But as we see in the closing verse of chapter 1, we see that more, in fact, is going on here. We see that God had not forgotten Naomi. He was not punishing her, and he was, in fact, working out a greater purpose. This is what the closing verse of chapter 1 says. It says, now they arrived in Bethlehem at the beginning of the barley harvest. Now, we might read that as saying, they just so happened to arrive at the beginning of the barley harvest. But as the story unfolds, we realize that God had even this detail in mind. God didn't leave anything to chance, and he didn't miss a beat. In her continued commitment to her mother-in-law, Ruth goes out into these barley fields to try and earn some kind of income, so she would go behind the men as they were gathering husks of grain, and she with the other woman would gather the leftovers. And if you think about it, as a foreign woman out in the middle of a field surrounded by men, wasn't exactly the safest place for Ruth to be. But the story goes on, chapter 2 now, in verse 3. Now she just happened to end up in the portion of the field belonging to Boaz. Who was Boaz? Not only was he wealthy, not only was he prominent, but he was also a relative of Naomi's deceased husband. And that's an important detail, as we will soon find out. And as Ruth is out working in his fields, it says in verse 4 now of chapter 2, at that very moment, there we go again, Boaz arrived from Bethlehem to greet his workers. And as he is out there talking to his harvesters, Ruth catches his notice. And as he inquires, as to who is this foreign woman working in his field, one of his servants gives the full story of Ruth's kindness to her mother-in-law. And Boaz is clearly impressed by her character. You know, to be living during a time of injustice and selfishness, where each person is looking after their own interests, to hear the story and to see someone else expressing their kindness, to giving of themselves for someone else, sometimes that's enough to capture someone's heart and imagination, and that seems to be the case for Boaz. he meets Ruth, and he tells her, do not go into any other field. Work only in my fields. And he tells the men working for him not to harass her, and he even tells his harvesters to pull out ears of grain to let them fall on the ground so that Ruth might pick them up. And this is what Boaz says in verse 12 now of chapter 2. May the Lord reward your efforts. May your acts of kindness be repaid fully by the Lord, God of Israel, from whom you have sought protection. Boaz recognized that it was God in whom Ruth had placed her trust. And it was this faith that she had that enabled her to step out in confidence despite her circumstances, despite the odds being stacked against her. It was her faith that enabled her to look beyond her own needs and to care for the needs of another. And Boaz was wise enough to recognize that God was at work in her life and that God, in fact, was Ruth's protector. And we might also notice that Boaz had more than just an abstract theology. He recognized that God had blessed him so he could be a blessing. Boaz was confident that God was Ruth's protector, and yet he saw also that as one of God's people, he shared in that responsibility. When God made the old covenant with the people of Israel, one of the conditions of that covenant was that the people were to care for the vulnerable in their society. That was one of the conditions. In Deuteronomy chapter 10, it says this, for the Lord your God is the God of gods and the Lord of lords, the great, mighty, and awesome God who is unbiased, who takes no bribe, who justly treats the orphan and the widow, and who loves the resident foreigners, giving them food and clothing. So you must love the resident foreigner, because you were foreigners in the land of Egypt. And in Deuteronomy 27, as God lays before the people of Israel the covenant conditions, the blessings and the curses, this is what God says. He says to them, cursed is the one who perverts justice for the resident foreigner, the orphan, or the widow. And when you read through the Old Testament, the book of Isaiah comes to mind. When you read through them, you realize that one of the reasons why God had brought judgment upon his people, one of the reasons why they had gone into exile, is because they had abused the foreigners, the widows, the orphans in their midst, rather than protecting them. And really all throughout the Old Testament, we read of God's concern for the vulnerable. And one of the ways in which God sought to provide for the vulnerable was by establishing what he called the kinsman redeemer. Okay, so a kinsman redeemer was a person's relative who was rich, who was powerful, who had the capacity to protect them should they become impoverished. So the kinsman redeemer would act by paying off a debt. They would act by buying a relative's property so they wouldn't have to sell themselves into slavery. They would even act by marrying a widow if she had no children. And that is who Boaz was for Naomi and for Ruth. He was their kinsman redeemer. And so when Ruth returns to Naomi and describes how she's been working out in the field of Boaz and how she's met him and what he said, Naomi begins to hatch a plan of how they might try and convince Boaz to take up his responsibility to care for them. Because being redeemer would be costly, right? How would this man respond to the news that he now had a social and financial responsibility to these two women? And so Naomi gives these instructions to Ruth, chapter 3 now in verse 3. And as we read what she says, we might say Naomi had something of a desperate kind of faith. But I think there was a boldness in her instructions. And maybe she felt like she had to somehow help the hand of God along. I don't know, but I think she had a faith in what God had provided. But this is what she says. These are the instructions she gave Ruth. She said, bathe yourself, rub on some perfume, and get dressed up. So in other words, make yourself as physically appealing as possible. And then she says, go down to the threshing floor where Boaz is working, but don't let him know you're there. When he gets ready to go to sleep, take careful notice of the place where he lies down, then go, uncover his legs, and lie down next to him. He'll tell you what to do. Now that sounds very weird and very strange, and it is, but for whatever reason, in that day and age, in that culture, that uncovering of his legs was equivalent to a marriage proposal. So in our day and age, if it's considered somewhat unusual for a woman to propose to a man, how much more then, right? And Ruth, you know, in her, you know, true to character, follows her mother-in-law's advice as an act of devotion and service, and she goes down to the threshing floor. She sees where Boaz lies down, and she waits for him to go to sleep. She uncovers his legs and lies down next to him. And Boaz, of course, when he wakes up, is quite alarmed to find this woman lying next to him, and he asks, who are you? What are you doing lying next to me? And Ruth cuts the chase. Chapter 3 and verse 9, Ruth says this, I am Ruth, your servant. Marry your servant, for you are the guardian of the family interests. Doesn't mess around, cuts the chase. And someone like me, after working a full day of hard labor, I probably would have been annoyed to have been woken up during the night. But Boaz is amazed. He is amazed at the level of devotion that Ruth showed to her mother-in-law. There are indications in the text that Boaz was no longer a young man and that there were other options for Ruth that she could have pursued. But this is what Boaz says in verse 10. He says, may the Lord reward you. This act of devotion is greater than what you did before. You have not sought to marry one of the young men, whether rich or poor. And he goes on to say that he will be the redeemer. He will marry her. He will buy the field of Naomi and provide for them. But he says, first, there is a legal issue that needs to be settled. And here we see that Boaz is not only compassionate, but we see his integrity. There was a relative living in Bethlehem who was a relative of Naomi who was actually first in line to be redeemer for Naomi and for Ruth. He had first dibs, so to speak, and Boaz didn't want to overstep himself, and he didn't want to trample on another man's legal rights. And so, as was the custom, Boaz goes to the city gate. He waits for the man to walk by so he can summon him. And it's telling that in the text, it does not tell us what this man's name is. It just says the man or John Doe or whatever. And that's a clue in and of itself of who this man was. But Boaz, when he sees him walk by the city gate, he summons him along with the elders of the city. And he tells him, you have first dibs. You have first rights to buy Naomi's field. You are her redeemer. The man says, okay, I'll redeem her field. And Boaz says, there's more. You have to not only redeem her field, you must also marry Ruth, who is a widow. And this is what the man says. Then I am unable to redeem it, for I would ruin my own inheritance. I would ruin my own inheritance. It wasn't so much that the man was unable as unwilling. Because if he married Ruth and provided her with an offspring, that offspring would inherit that land. And you know, all throughout this story, we see this contrast between the faithful and the faithless, those willing to give themselves away versus those trying to preserve their lives. And it's a challenge, isn't it? Because everything within our natural selves tells us to play it safe, right? To preserve our lives, to take control of our own destinies. And yet God has called us to live with risk in our hearts. God has called us to give our lives away, trusting him that he alone holds our futures in his hand and that he is the faithful one. And one of the truly amazing things about God, and that you see depicted so well in the story, is that he not only works out the big picture, the meta-narrative, the larger story, but he also cares for the small details. the individual cares and concerns of the average person. And as the story of Ruth comes to a close, we see how God has done this beautifully. Chapter 4 and verse 13. So Boaz married Ruth. The Lord enabled her to conceive and gave birth to a son. The village women said to Naomi, "May the Lord be praised, because he has not left you without a guardian today. May he become famous in Israel. He will encourage you and provide for you when you are old, for your daughter-in-law, who loves you, has given birth to him. She is better to you than seven sons." And it says, Naomi took the child and placed him on her lap, and she became his caregiver. Despite all initial appearances, God had not forgotten Naomi. He knew her every need, her every concern, and he was with her on that journey, through the ups and downs, through the suffering. Even in her bitterness, God was there. He was providing. But God was also providing a larger purpose. He had a larger plan in mind, which he had woven into the fabric of these people's lives. The amazing thing is that as Ruth and the other faithful people in this story stepped out in faith, here was God working out his own faithfulness through them. This is what it says in verse 17 now. The neighborhood women named him, the child, saying, "A son has been born to Naomi," and they named him Obed. Now he became the father of Jesse, and Jesse was the father of David. It's not till the very end of the story that we see the full picture of what God was doing, what God was working out through the tragedy of one woman, through the faithfulness of another, and through the integrity of one man who was committed to God's justice. God was providing. Not only was God providing for them, but he was providing for all of us. God's plan all along was to provide our ultimate redeemer. Obed was the father of Jesse. Jesse was the father of David. And through the lineage of David came the Messiah, came the Christ, Jesus, our redeemer, who would not only buy our freedom from sin, but also from death. And let us not forget that it was costly for him as well as our Redeemer. He gave up his fullness. He emptied himself so that we would not be empty. He gave his life away so that we might know life in all its fullness. Isn't that a beautiful thing to reflect upon this morning? And so as we come to a close here, you know, I hope I haven't misrepresented what I'm trying to say. You know, I'm not trying to set the bar higher for us. I'm not trying to say, do more, jump higher. You know, we're already doing so much. What I really want to do is encourage you, the mothers, the women, and really all of us this morning, that what you do matters, that your faith matters. Your acts of devotion and care, even if they go unnoticed by those around you, they don't go unnoticed by God. And, you know, through the ups and downs of life, through the extraordinary and the mundane, and whether you're going through a season of joy or of sorrow, God is there, and he has not forgotten you. And he is, in fact, weaving together a design for your lives that is far, far more beautiful and far greater than what we could imagine for ourselves. So I want to encourage all of you this morning to keep stepping out in faith, trusting that God is, God himself is faithful. He is our provider and protector, and he will never leave us. He will never abandon us. So that is something to rejoice about this morning, and I hope that was encouraging for you in some way. And I think the only thing left for us to do is to rejoice and to stand and sing together. So let's do that at this time.